89.1 FM on the dial and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Tom Lounges, and it's time for Midwest Beat, 2 hours of talk and music. That's right. This is a show all about music and the people who make it. Coming up the second hour, I will have a young lady named Becca Loeb. She's part of Nobody's Girl, a trio out of Texas. We're going to get to that a little later, but coming up before then, in just a few minutes, an old friend will be revisiting us once again. Doug Cosmo Clifford, drummer, co-founder of Creedence Clearwater Revival, is back on the program to talk about his project, Clifford Wright, for All the Money in the World. It's coming out in August. We'll talk to Cliff, or we'll talk to Cosmo after this. Good afternoon and welcome to Midwest Beat here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM on the dial, streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. This program is all about music and the people who make it. Coming up on the second hour, we'll have Becca Loeb. She's part of a great young group called Nobody's Girl, a trio of female singers, songwriters, and we'll be hearing a lot from them soon. But coming up first, Doug Cosmo Clifford, co-founder of Creedence Clearwater Revival, the beatkeeper of that group, and of course a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, inducted back in 1993. Well, we're going to get Doug on the phone to talk about a new project, actually an old new project, something recorded a while back that is just now coming out in August. It's called Clifford Wright. So who's Mr. Wright? We'll find out. All after this, let's play the title track from this new Clifford Wright album. It's aptly titled, For All the Money in the World. What would you do? All the money in the world makes you wonder, what would you do? What would you not do for all the money in the world? One of those questions you just wake up pondering sometimes. And that was a question pondered a while back, but soon to be released, August 27th, It's off the album, aptly titled For All the Money in the World, by Clifford Wright. And that brings us to our guest. He's a repeat guest here on the program. Doug Cosmo Clifford is a founding member of Creedence Clearwater Revival. He's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee back in 1993, and he is half of Clifford Wright. Welcome, Doug.
Welcome, Tom.
Last time you were on, you were releasing some of your own solo albums, in which we learned that you could sing pretty darn good. And now I find that you've been sitting on some great stuff in your vault. So let's talk about the program of what you've got lined up here. I understand there's more than just the Clifford Wright project we're going to feature today.
Oh, that's correct. I've got a beautiful vault full of a lot of great music from a lot of different performances by some pretty great artists. So eventually it will all come out, but right now we're working on the Clifford Wright project, and we got a pretty good singer and Keith England on that one, and got Steve Wright, of course. It's his last recording. He passed away in 2017, so this will be a chance for him to shine posthumously. And then we have Joe Satriani on guitar. We have Greg Douglas on guitar, and we have Jimmy Lyon on guitar. So kind of a guitar smorgasbord,
right,
if you will. And then a couple of keyboard guys from other various bands. And yeah, it's pretty exciting.
So when exactly was this recorded, and how did we not know you were working on these vault projects?
I missed the first part of that question.
I said, when were these actually recorded? They're just coming out now, but they've been, you know, you've been sitting on these a while, and it was kept a pretty good secret there. So when did you actually start recording these different projects with different musical friends, and what was go ahead.
The one we're talking about right now is Clifford Wright project, and that was probably 9 different recording sessions with different people. That's why there's 3 guitar players there. It didn't all happen at once. It happened on 3 different sessions. So that was in 1980. It's mid 1980. I would say probably 86 is where a lot of that recording was done.
Wow. So CCR, you guys were done with that. John had done his solo stuff, and you and Stu had done the country side of things that you were working on. Let's talk about why this came about. What prompted you to, like, call up friends and say, hey, we're going to make some music together, but we're not going to release it?
Well, I had no intention, really, of releasing it to the public. I was going to send it to labels because Steve and I co-wrote all the music. And so every song that you're listening to was written by the two of us. So the idea would be to let a record company know that we're the writers of the project, and this is some of the things that we can do. So it was never intended to go out publicly. Here it is. It managed to get out of the vault, which was a sort of a Houdini type move to be able to do that. And the key was hidden carefully in my earlobe, and opened that vault up. And there's some things in there with Bobby Whitlock. There's some things in there with Doug Somm. I've got a few other surprises, some more solo stuff of mine. So right now it's a summertime rock and roll record, and boy do we need summertime rock and roll these days.
Definitely. Well, that first song is so upbeat. You know, when people say, oh yeah, Doug was with Creedence Clearwater Revival and Revisited, and you know, you got that swamp rock kind of groove with that band. This is so different from what you've done, even different from your solo album, which we talked about last time, which was a lot of studio work. when you were writing these songs in the 80s, did you think, what was the goal of it? If you weren't planning to release it and you were just going to have fun with it and you were writing songs with Stephen, were you planning to shop these songs to other artists?
No, we were planning to shop these songs to labels.
Okay.
We were trying to get a record deal. That was the whole purpose of it. But if you do that and you get a response from a label, then they're going to want to come see you play. And we weren't playing any gigs at that time. That didn't help matters much. But upon rediscovery and then listening and reviewing all the different things that I had, I said, this is a hit record. There's singles in here. And one song follows the other. There's no real wasted time in there. So we went about the writing part of it very, very carefully, and we wanted to have a sort of a rock and roll feel to it. But we wanted to show various sides of rock and roll, sort of different genres within a genre.
Are you releasing anything in advance of this album, which comes out, I believe, in August 27th? Are you releasing any, like, I guess you'd call it a single, even though singles don't technically really exist anymore. Are you doing anything to kind of preempt the album's arrival?
We are. Last week we put out For All the Money, and it's the title of the album as well, so I've been in this business a long time, so you try to get as much gravity as you can to get into people's minds so they'll be thinking about you when they might want to download a single. Well, we've got one right now ready to go, and it's the one that you just played for your audience for All the Money in the World. And then on the 3rd of August, we've got another single coming out called I Need Your Love, and that's the second song on the album. So it goes For All the Money in the World, that's the first single, and then the second single, I Need Your Love, and then that's then the next release is the album on the 27th.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that song in just a minute. Have you gotten response back yet from radio or from media on For All the Money in the World, the single? Have you gotten even fan-based stuff? What kind of response have you gotten from it?
Well, the response I've gotten from it is, I've been doing a lot of podcasts and doing everything I can to help get it airplay. And the response I get is people love it. I mean, I've been sort of really pleasantly surprised. And they said, it doesn't really sound like it was from the 80s. It sounds like it could be fresh, right off the press. So yeah, people like it, and we'll know more next week to see what the effects are on radio as playlists come out and that sort of thing. But all we need is when people hear it, they like it. So
right.
We need to get as much airplay as we possibly can.
Well, on that note, let's play the second single in advance. This is called I Need Your Love. We'll be talking some more with Doug after this.
Miserable to tell me the same.
New music by way of the vault, actually old music being released now. I Need Your Love, that is the forthcoming second single from the new album For All the Money in the World, coming out August 27th. That is a project by Clifford Wright, Clifford Wright Project, featuring Stephen Wright and my guest, Doug Cosmo Clifford. Tell me about your singer, Doug. I like his voice, but I am not familiar with Keith England at all.
Well, Keith is a terrific guy, and everybody else that was on the session for this record had been in or would be in a band that had platinum records. All the other guys, a lot of them were in the Greg Kinn Band, some in Eddie Money, and some with Steve Miller. So there were... Keith is the only one that he was a background singer for the Osmond Brothers. Did I say Osmond Brothers?
That's what it sounded like.
Oh man, that's not who I was thinking about. I'm having a brain fart here. I'm almost on the floor with that one.
I was almost on the floor thinking you got a guy from the Osmonds.
who are the Greg Allman, the Allman?
Oh, the brothers. Allman Brothers. Okay.
Yeah, I was close.
Yeah.
in the sound of the name only, not in the music.
Right.
But anyway, you know, that's his as close as he got. So he called. In fact, while we were doing this interview, I heard a beep, 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 and I looked, and it's Keith. He's just a terrific guy. He can still hit the notes, and he's been holding on to the dream for 30 years, and I would love to have a success, especially for him. You know, I'm really rooting for him. He's a very talented guy, unsung hero, if you will, and I think he did just a fabulous job of not only singing the songs, but taking the personality of each song and giving it its own personality.
He is amazing. That's why I can't believe I've not heard of him before. I'm like, who is this guy and where'd he come from? And on that note, how did you find him to make this project? Everybody else, of course, like you said, has a great resume. Jimmy Lyon with Eddie Money, and of course, Steve Satriani goes unsaid. And everybody knows Stephen Wright from the Greg Kinn Band. I mean, he was on most of the big hits and the big albums back for Berserkly.
Right. Well, we've for the session, a good friend of ours, an engineer, brought him to our session and/slash audition. We were looking for singers at that point in time, he brought Keith along with him. He says, "I think I got your guy." And I said, "Where is he?" You know, I looked at him; he was very young and upbeat and kind of a bit of a character, and so I said, "Well, let's go. Here's a couple of songs we can try out that you would know. You wouldn't know the ones that we've written because you've never heard them before." So we tried him out. I don't remember the songs that we chose, but we put his throat to the test for sure, and he just slayed the audition, just killed it beautifully. And at that point, when we were finished, there were two guys standing to be the next candidates. And I told them to go home. And I said, "We've got our guy now." And they said, "Well, you didn't give us a chance." I said, "Talking to you, I can tell right away that you won't come anywhere near this guy, and I want to move on and try and do some recording here." So sorry, we've got our guy. So, and what a terrific find Keith has been.
Now, with this album being the self-contained Clifford Wright album, did you use Keith on any of the other Vault stuff that will be forthcoming down the road? Will we hear more of him?
You will not. So another reason to this record has some real special things. It's got Steve Wright's last recorded venture, and what a tremendous bass player he is. I've been fortunate in my career to have some pretty good bass players to play with, and Stu Cook comes to mind for sure. And,
right.
Steve Wright. Wow, you know, terrific guy. And then we had a really good writing style. We would rent a space in a rehearsal hall, bring a guitar, and I'd bring my drums, and we had a boombox. And then I had a little Sonny cassette player, and that's my note taker. I did the same thing with Creedence Clearwater Revival. I would put it next to my drum in the rehearsal space, in a place where all the instruments could be heard. And then I would record things that I thought needed work. So I would get a copy of it and be my note taker. I'd take it home, put it on my fourth track, and then I would try out different ideas and things till I found something that I thought would work and be the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did this. I would do the same thing, only to a different level. I would end up writing the song instead of just finding parts for it, a John Fogerty song. So that was a really good way to write, and I had exactly what I needed. And most of the time, I was writing the verse, the melodies of the verse, and certainly all the lyrics. And then most of the time, Steve was coming up with chorus ideas, and for all the money, that was a home run. He said, "Hey, listen to this," and then he played the chorus and sang the line. I said, "That is a hit, right? Just as it is. I got a little work to do to finish it up, but what a home run! A terrific, terrific song, and it's turned out to be, our first single. And I miss him. I'm sure he would have been thrilled to hear how good it's turned out."
You mentioned that these were his last sessions. He passed in 2017, but this was recorded in the 80s. So, what was he doing in between the 80s and 2017? I mean, he didn't retire, did he?
He had a heart attack and a stroke, and he wasn't able to play. Maybe he played some other sessions, but I've not heard them. In other words, what I'm saying is that this is a record that's out and available, and he's playing on it, and he's playing on all 11 songs.
Okay.
So it's an effort that. It's a complete effort by him. And, it really shows, just how good he was. And it was fun playing with him. And as you said, the songs are different than anything that I have been involved with in the past. And that's because of what he was able to do and how he inspired me. With his playing, it could have been a really, really great one, but it just wasn't to be. And so once that happened, I put it in the vault for a long snooze, and here we are talking about it on the radio.
Why was this the right time, Doug, to release this after all these years of sitting there? What made you say, "I'm going to go in the vault and go through my stuff, and this will be the first of the archives to come out"? Why was this the right time?
Well, a lot of things. The pandemic is certainly a life changer. I mean, this is something that is like the Black Plague. It's a horrible thing, and it's deadly, and all those things. I hadn't gotten into the vault because I didn't have anything more to put in there, and so I just had it stored in a cabinet in my garage, where it was nice and cool, and where tape could be stored. So I was cleaning up stuff in my studio, and I found a notepad with songs that we had written, and I went, oh, I remember this. So I went down and pulled the vault out, and there were other things in there as well. And I said, oh, I'm going to have to see if this stuff is still working, if the tape is going to fall off the reel or what. Mm-hmm. And so I got an engineer friend of mine. I said, how do we do this? do I dare put it on a reel-to-reel and turn on the switch? Or he says, oh, we're going to have to bake it. And I said, hey, we're not making brownies here. What do you mean we have to bake it? And he explained the technique. And you do. You bake it. And I said, wow. How high-tech is that?
Wow.
Turn on the oven to 350 or 250 or whatever it was. You know, and then the next thing you know, you've got a record in your hand. So anyway, we put everything that was in there through that process and took it to digital so we would not lose it. I haven't touched the tape since. And they all turned out. Every single one of them came out, so.
Well, I remember when you released Cosmo right before the pandemic. I think it was beginning of 19 that we talked last, and the quality on that was stellar. And was that and is this album, the Clifford Wright album, are these from multi-track master tapes, or are these already mixed down and you just had a work tape to reissue?
They were all mastered, two tracks, and which made it pretty difficult to... So a friend of mine, Russell DeShiel, who played lead guitar on my solo album and also recorded it, he was a recording engineer on the session, I said, I'm going to put this out, and so why don't you be the co-producer on it, and I'll kind of guide you the way what I want to do with our limited situation. Mm-hmm. And he's a Pro Tools genius, so I said, I want to take this out, and I want to try and bring the snare drum up as much as we can. Well, when you do that with a two-track master, all you're doing is finding a frequency that drum is in. If you're working on a drum, which I was, and then you pinpoint that, and then you boost the level of it a little bit. Now, the downside to that is anything else on that record that is in that frequency is going to go up as well.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't, but most of the time the things that we wanted to do, we were able to do it. And he even added a whole new rhythm track to one of the songs. I forget which one, but he played guitar on, opened a track and put a guitar on there. And then a few other things he did with the lead guitar, some parts, and because he had played on it, we had the sound and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an interesting use of technology when you have you're limited to a two-track master.
So was that the same with the Clifford Wright album as well as it was with Cosmo, and is it the same situation with the future releases?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So will Russell be working with you on all of these archival pieces?
He will. In fact, he's the executive producer on Clifford Wright. He didn't play on it, and he didn't record on it, but you know he helped me with it in terms of getting the result that I wanted to get. And so I said, hey, you know, right, now you're the executive producer. You okay. Like that, you know. Give him some credit where credit is due.
One of the things I really like about the Clifford Wright album is the way you guys have the vocal harmonies going. But I'm only seeing Keith England listed as a singer. Now, were you guys harmonizing? I know you sing. Were you harmonizing with him as background, or did you multi-track Keith on his own?
Well, we did both.
Okay.
There were some parts where we doubled up and also some parts where he sang a harmony against his own voice. But most of the harmony vocals were me Steve and Keith. And I've always loved harmony background. Anything that I produce, you're going to hear that. Mm-hmm. You're going to hear the harmony voice. I just always loved it. And and Steve had sang harmony with Greg Ken. And so we got the voices that could get the three-part harmonies. And that was myself, Steve, and Keith.
Okay. Now, you guys ended CCR, I want to say 72, 73, if I remember, and your Cosmo album came out around the same time. Was that something you jumped right into? Was it something you were working on as the band was wrapping up its run?
Well, yes, because Stu and I decided we had a lease on Cosmo's factory, the old factory, which was Creedence's headquarters. That's where we rehearsed. We never recorded there. But we rehearsed there, and we had a space where we could drive in, and had an office there. And when we drove in, we were just another factory on the block. Nobody would know that it was a rock and roll band headquarters there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the lease, and so Stu and I decided that we would start a production company and get some use out of some of the talent that was around us at the time in the Bay Area. And in order to do that, we would need a remote vehicle as a studio for us. We would back the truck into the building and then run a snake from the truck that was pre-wired with a 16-track into the rehearsal space where we rehearsed all the albums.
Hmm.
And it had a good sound to it, but we didn't know how it was going to show up on tape. So I was under contract. All of us were still under contract. So
I went to
Fantasy and got a budget. And that was the first thing I did. I got a budget, and then I got a bunch of guys I always wanted to record with. And wrote some songs and recorded the album with the snake, and it turned out to be true. So it was an experiment, not a work of art, and that showed up in my singing. I didn't think I sang very well on that album, and that was the weak part of it. And so when I did the most recent solo album, I had really worked on my singing voice, and it made a huge difference. On the performance, and that was a work of art. That was a planned work of art. Whereas the first one was an experiment, so I had a different motivation.
Okay.
For it. I brought in Tower Power horns. I brought in Donald Duck Dunn. I brought in John McPhee from the Doobie Brothers. So I brought in a lot of my friends who I'd always wanted to record with to do that. Do that first album. So that part was fun. There's some good playing on it, but I didn't sing very well.
Okay. Well, that's debatable. You're too critical of yourself. I think the fans enjoyed the heck out of that album.
Well, I didn't see any Rotten Tomatoes on the building when I left. So
while you dabbled with that for a while, and then after the CCR thing, Stu, of course, went on to Southern Pacific and had a good run for a good 10 years or so. So while he was doing that, you were basically woodshedding with all your favorite musicians and making all these amazing albums that we're hopefully soon going to be hearing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So were you were writing that whole time. You kind of disappeared off the radar, so people didn't know what happened to you, but you never stopped working. That's interesting to hear.
I always wanted to be a writer, and the way you learn is to do it. I had some guys that were in a band with Bobby Whitlock. Once he left, and then I was writing and recording songs in my house, just four-track stuff, nothing really fancy. with Tom Miller and David Vega, guitarist and bass player. And then I, most all of what I was doing then was I was writing by myself. I wasn't co-writing. I wanted to get to a certain level before I started working with somebody else. Because I didn't want to be in the way. Mm-hmm. So I just got to a point where, I wanted to work with other people and see how that would go. And when I co-write with just one other person. I don't want to have three people or more than that. Two is perfect. That allows for a focus. But I've worked with three guys. There was always arguments and differences over, I wrote one more line than you, so I should get an extra 5%. I'm like, wait
right.
a minute. let's think about the music here. So
right.
All the co-writes that I have are me and one other person. And that works
very
great.
Easy to split that up.
Very easy to split it up. And if you do enough, it's going to work out in the end. And money shouldn't be the thing that, is the driving the boat. It's the art that you really want to get. And so you get somebody that's compatible and knowledgeable and has the same sort of taste that you have or not. That's another side of it too. So like with Steve, a lot of the stuff that we wrote, I never would have written. I wouldn't have thought to do it, and there's some songs in there that I really like that you tell people that that's me playing drums and they go, wow, that's a different groove for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true on all of these songs. They all are a little bit different. I like that. Let's play one. What is a song off here that you really like that you feel represents well besides the two we already played?
Lost Pride's Fever or She Told Me So. Steve Miller favorite song on that album is She Told Me So.
Okay, well, let's do that. We're going to play that. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk some more with Doug and find out a little bit about how some of this came together, a little more detailed. And then I want to talk about that cover art, because that is pretty mind-blowing, too. So stay with us. This is Midwest Beats with Doug Cosmo Clifford and me, Tom Lounges. Stay with us.
She said,
She told me so. New music, Clifford Wright is the artist, and the recordings were done in the 80s, but you'd never know it. Coming out August 27th. Doug is my guest, Doug Clifford. And Doug, is this coming out on your own label, or who's releasing this?
It's coming out on my own label, Cliff Song Music, distributed by Sony Orchard. So I have the big time distributor with Bob Frank, a veteran of the record business, who has made a deal with Sony. And so it'll be on my label. And this is one record company I won't have to audit. So.
That's true.
Kind of excited about that.
Now, how did you and Stephen Wright hook up? I mean, he is well known for the Greg Kinn Band. He was on all the big hit albums. He co-wrote so many of the songs, including the hits, like the breakup song he was a co-write on. How did you guys get to be friends and make this project come together?
Well, he lived in El Cerrito, which is where we grew up, and where Creedence started in the eighth grade, actually. And his brother played guitar. He had an older brother, but he was younger than the three of us. He was a grade behind us. And we were thinking about putting him in and maybe Stu moving over to bass. Because Stu was playing piano in an instrumental trio with John and myself. But the problem with that was, you know, his brother was kind of a wise guy. And he was in fights all the time. And we were playing some pretty rough joints back in those days. And we thought about it and we said, you know, if he's in the band, we're going to be getting our asses kicked and our instruments broken. So we changed that whole thing. So now we're going to keep it as a trio. Well, anyway, Steve was a fan of Creedence, and he was younger. I forget how much younger than me, but you know, 5, maybe 6 years. He came to my house. I had met him and knocked on the door and introduced himself, and I recognized him from his brother, and he looked quite a bit alike, and so we talked music and hung out a little bit, and one thing led to another, and we said, you know, let's try and throw some songs together. So we did, and once we got to a certain point, we said, we got some songs here. We should probably get a band together, and if nothing else, we should record these things, because, you know, we could shop these songs or whatever. So we did that, and we recorded, and thought, you know, it would be great to have a band. And we can just be the writers, and the writing thing was just so smooth and easy, and we were getting some pretty decent results. So that's how that all started. We didn't go out and play, and that's what kind of killed it. We needed to be a playing band, so at least, you know, for enough to be able to play a decent show for record company people, because in those days, A&R guys actually did things. They would go and see bands, meet people in bands, and now it's different in that way in the business, or at least I've seen it that way. So that's how we got into the guitar heaven thing. You know, it's pretty funny because, you know, when we did the thing with Joe, we asked him if he wanted to join the band. He said no. He was working on a heavy metal instrumental, and we looked at him and said, "Good luck with that, buddy." And I will say, last laughs are always the best laughs, and he had the best lap on all of us on that one.
Right. Yeah, he was playing with Greg Kinn, so I imagine that's how that that he got recruited for this was through through Steve, right?
Right.
Okay. Greg Douglas also played with Greg Kinn. Yeah. So you've got a lot of the Greg Kinn guys with you on this.
Well, so did Jimmy.
Okay.
Jimmy Lyon did as well. So it's almost like a farm team for Clifford Wright, but, you know, I don't mean that in a negative sense towards Greg. Greg's a friend of mine, and you know, he had a great little band. So
yeah, he's still making good music. I had him on a couple of years back when he did Pink Flamingos, another great album that sadly didn't get on the radar too well.
Well, I know that he's working on one right now. I talked to him about it briefly when I was trying to get a hold of Joe to, you know, tell him what I'm doing and so on and so forth. And so I talked a bit with Greg, and he was working on an album. So hopefully there will be something coming from him as well.
Yeah, he's been working with his son, I think, a lot on some stuff.
Yeah, he sure has.
So with as you were mentioning, in the old days, the bands would come out, we would do these listening parties, the labels would rent a suite, and I remember all those days, and everybody would be having a little wine and hors d'oeuvres and saying hi to the band and playing politics and giving everybody their promo copy personally. Without those days, coming from the old school way, how are you going to market this? Because I know you said you're not performing anymore. Will you put a band together with Keith maybe to go out on the road, even if you're not performing?
Yeah, that's not something that we've really discussed, but that's in the back of my mind for sure. And if we get to the point where, you know, we're getting some airplay and we need a little extra something, I would probably do a video, and I would probably play on that video.
Okay.
To market it, but I just can't go out. I've got Parkinson's, and it's not quite affecting my play. And if I did a video, I would be lip syncing anyway. I would be. We wouldn't play the song live. We would do what you do with a video. So I can do that without any problem, and have Keith there we'll have to figure out who would be in the bass slot.
Maybe Stu. Slot. Maybe get Stu back in action.
I don't know that he'd want to do that.
Okay.
In the tropics now and living the tropic life. He's on a golf course there, and I think he's burned out on the travel side, and you know, I just couldn't take it's bad enough flying before the pandemic, but you know, I can just imagine what it's like going through airports and chasing planes and what the state of travel is right now. Don't want anything to do with that. I miss the fans, and I miss the guys in the band, and that hour and a half on stage. But the other 22 and a half hours you can have.
Right. Well, you have plenty of projects. How many would you say are in the vault that we're going to hopefully be seeing in the coming months and years?
At least four albums.
Okay. And you mentioned one has Doug Sam on it. I am a huge, huge Sir Douglas fan, and I'm excited about that. You did on Cosmo, you covered Doug Sam.
Yeah, I did. And as a producer, probably one of the best, if not the best albums I ever produced was Groover's Paradise.
Hmm.
By Doug Sam.
Right.
And if you're not familiar with that one, you should really get a hold of it, because it really Doug was hard to work with, because he was you know, just everywhere, bouncing off the walls, and I had to really, you know, get him to focus on what we were doing, and he respected me, and I was one of the few guys that could tell him, you know, what he had to do, because he was cross-pollinating some of the songs God knows what, and you know, and he said, "Oh, I'm not stoned enough." So I think that you've got that backwards. But anyway, make a long story short, it showcases all the things he can do. He's probably the most talented guy I ever worked with.
Yeah, he was a gift that was taken much too soon.
Oh yeah, no question about it. But if you have a chance to download Groover's Paradise, get that record. If you're a fan, you'll love that record.
Okay, I will look for that. I don't think I've heard that one. That's an earlier one.
Oh man, yeah, that was in '74.
Okay. Okay.
I did three albums with two of them I produced.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I hope that's the second one coming out. Is he all over that one? Is it something like this where you've got him as a co-writer?
Well, no, I'm not a writer on that one.
Okay.
And that would be the only one that I'm not. But, you know, it's him. And it's just before they became the Texas Tornadoes.
Okay. Excellent.
But Freddie Fender wasn't present at that one. He hadn't come into the picture yet. But he is just an absolute terrific talent. And like I say, I have the multi-track on that. But before that one comes out, I'm going to put out the Bobby Whitlock one because I think that that'll definitely get traction.
Okay. Is Coco on that one, his wife?
No, this is pre-Coco. This
pre-Coco.
Is 1978.
Okay. So that was after the Harrison sessions and before Coco.
Yes.
Okay, that should be interesting. I do want to touch on the amazing cover of the Clifford Wright project for All the Money in the World. It's like a high-speed, blurry, running down the highway, multicolored, trippy-looking graphic. What was the thought behind that cover?
I had nothing to do with that cover. I gave my son did it.
Oh.
He's my graphic arts guy. He did my solo album cover, but which is a photograph of me, or at least my head and shoulders, and some nice subtle little things. But this one, I just said I need a cover, and so I waited a week and said, "You got something?" And he said, "Yep." Sent it over, and I said, "Wow, this is cool."
Yeah, it is. I like it.
The Clifford family does album covers. My wife did the cover for Creedence's first album.
Oh.
Yeah, she recently, or a year or so ago, got into the DeYoung Museum with that cover. They did a thing for covers of for the 60s. Lo and behold, somebody called up my wife and said, "Hey, you're in the DeYoung Museum." "What do you mean?" And sure enough, she made it. So, yeah, Clifford's make records and make art for the records.
And also produce. And even though you don't think you sing well, I think you sing well. So keep going.
Thank you.
Is your son following in your footsteps musically too? I mean, or is he just working in the business?
He's an artist, and he doesn't play an instrument.
Okay.
He has an old sitar, and once in a while he'll smoke a joint, go play a couple of strings, pull a couple of strings on it, and I get a kick out of it. But that's about it.
All right.
My daughter plays piano, guitar, and harmonica and flute. My oldest son plays guitar and keyboards, but they don't do music. It's just sort of something.
Just a fun thing.
They do once in a while. It's a fun thing, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to play a final song as we get ready to say goodbye, but I did have a listener that emailed me and says, "Please, for the love of God, ask him how he got the nickname Cosmo." Of course, we know Cosmo's Factory is the studio rehearsal hall. We have the album of the same title, but how did you become Cosmo?
Well, we had a little gardener's shack in a rented house before we had made it. I was living in it, and that's where we practiced. I mean, it was like maybe 6 feet by 12 feet, just really stupid. And we had rugs tacked on the walls, and so there wasn't a very good flow of oxygen in it. And everybody smoked cigarettes in the band but me. And they would be in there, and we would be rehearsing, and the cigarette smoke was killing me. So I stood up and swore and threw my sticks on the floor, walked outside and took some deep breaths. Tom Fogarty came out and said, what's wrong? You guys, your cigarettes are killing me. He says, well, it's better than working in a factory somewhere. And so my wife, as I said, is an artist. She had some oil paints. And so I took a 1x4 piece of wood and cut it to 18 inches. And I wrote the factory on it and painted each letter a different color and tacked it under the door. And next day when they came, that was there. Now, where the Cosmo really came to the fore was in college. Stu and I lived in the animal house. There was no adult supervision in there, and there were guys would throw happy hamburgers and the wrappings on the floor. I mean, it was college kid boys,
you know, right?
Idiots. So we had a horrible ant and roach problem in there, and I have an insect background because habitat. Because I was an insect butterfly collector when I was younger, and I traded butterflies with guys all over the world, and it enabled me to have a real good collection without spending a fortune. And then as I would be hunting, I would be squatting down close to the ground so the butterflies didn't see me, and I started getting enamored by ants and the colony insects, and there's a collective intelligence. And so I quit the butterfly part of it because I didn't like killing them. That wasn't a fun thing to do. And started studying the colony insects. So we got together to try and clean up the house. And so I said, look, I can get rid of the ants. And we had insect companies come out, pest control. And they could never get rid of the ants. They could get rid of the roaches, but they couldn't get the ants. I said, I'll get them all. So, but you have to pick up after yourselves. You can't throw this shit around and expect not to have ants and roaches. So in those days, you could buy poison over the counter. Mm-hmm. So I got a gallon of this stuff, enough to kill half the people in New York City, and I made my poison balls. You have to kill the queen, because the queen is not a royal person. It's an egg-laying machine.
That's okay.
What it does, it recirculates and creates the larva that is going to, you know, continue the colony. So I had my poison that wouldn't kill the carriers of it, and it would get all the way to the queen, and eventually would knock her out. So, after 2 weeks, they were all gone. I did it, and I said, now if you keep it clean in here, the ants and roaches are going to be gone. So a week or so later, we were having a toga party or something silly like that,
mm-hmm.
and the first hippie in the house was a guy named Phil LaRocca, and they used to call me Clifford C. Clifford. Now, I don't know the origin of that, but hey, Clifford C. Clifford. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Somebody yelled, hey, Clifford C. Clifford, what does the C stand for? Before I could say anything, the first hippie in the house said, it stands for Cosmo. He's cosmic. He's a man of nature.
And it just stuck.
Like poop on the shoe.
Wow. Awesome. Well, Doug, I thank you for your time. I do appreciate it. And when you get the next album out, I hope you'll come back and join us. We'll talk and showcase some of that. Listeners, you can keep up with Doug at DougCosmoClifford.com. There is a picture of the new album. It comes out in August. And there's all kinds of interesting stuff here on the website. What should we play to close out? What's another song you'd like people to hear?
Well, there are so many, but I like Silhouette. See Your
Silhouettes.
Silhouette.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get to that now. All right.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And I wish you well with this, and I look forward to the next ones.
I appreciate your help.
All right. Thank you much. Be safe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You too.
This is new music. This is off the album from Clifford Wright, All the Money in the World, and I See Your Silhouette.
I always had a dream of loving you one day.
New music from Clifford Wright, Doug Clifford, Stephen Wright, and that's an album that's coming out in August, end of August, for All the Money in the World. Look for that. And again, check him out at DougCosmoClifford.com.